Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You're listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk. Hello, listeners. All right? How are you doing today? I hope you're doing fine, whichever part of Lapland you reside in. I hope you're having a reasonable day or night or morning or evening or afternoon or pre-evening or late afternoon or early pre-breakfast podcast listening session. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, I hope you're basically okay. Here's a new episode for you. That's nice. This one is episode number 833, and this time I'm joined by Anthony Rotuno, who you've probably heard on this podcast before. Anthony was a guest in the episodes about John Lennon from a couple of years ago, the meditation episode which we did at the beginning of last year, 2022, and also the episode we did about Monty Python and the Holy Grail, the film. So Anthony's been on the show a few times, but just as a reminder, Anthony is an English teacher like me. He's also a life coach, a musician, a writer, and a podcaster with no less than three podcasts to his name, one of which is called Glass Onion on John Lennon. The other is Film Gold, which is all about great films. And the third is called Life and Life Only, in which Anthony discusses a variety of topics, all as part of a search for inner and outer truth, which means, more or less, self-help, that's the sort of inner part, but also comments and observations about the world at large and the way it works. So that's the kind of outer truth part. So you know that on this podcast, I like to feature conversations with interesting guests to give you a chance to listen to natural English as it's spoken. So for this episode, I thought I would ask Anthony about some of the different topics that I've heard him talking about before on his podcast, Life and Life Only. I've collected a few of the topics that he's talked about in order to have what I hope will be a deep and meaningful conversation about various things. So here's a quick overview of the topics which I've chosen, all of them things which Anthony has discussed in more depth in episodes of his podcast. I have 12 topics in total. We managed to talk about six of them in this episode, so there will be a part two in which we discuss the other six topics. So here are the six things which are on the menu, so to speak, in this episode then. You'll see that they are quite diverse, quite sort of different, but Anthony has things to say about each one. So the first topic is Anthony's podcast, Life and Life Only. What's it all about? What does he talk about? And what are the main aims for his show? How can he explain the basic concept of the show? Then second is cats. Yeah, cats, the animals. What can we learn from cats in terms of self-care? And how can cats be good for our mental and physical health? Third is the Titanic. What does this disastrous event from history tell us all about the class system? Fourth is travelling. What are some of Anthony's travelling experiences? And what did Anthony learn when he lost his backpack, which was full of all his clothes and things, while he was travelling in Vietnam? Fifth, teaching English. How are psychology and interpersonal dynamics involved in language teaching in both group and one-to-one situations? And then number six is life coaching. What is it and how is it done? Okay, so that's an overview of what you can expect to hear in this episode. I hope you find it interesting and that you learn a few things and that it helps you get more English into your head. So let's crack on and get stuck into a conversation with Anthony about life, the universe, and everything, but mainly cats, big sinking ships, and English teaching. Hello, Anthony. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm very scared now about the weightiness of all these topics, but yeah, let's do it.
So my first topic is actually life and life only. That's the first topic. So the question is, what is life and life only, and what's it all about?
The podcast, yeah.
Well, yeah, and generally, what's life all about? But yeah, the podcast. What's the podcast all about then?
Right, in about 2013 is the first time I actually started thinking about doing podcast. It didn't happen for another 6 years, although I put a few things online. So I always had in my mind to do some sort of Beatles-related podcast, which turned out to be Glass Onion on John Lennon. But I had an idea for a general one because I have, I suppose, what is called an alternative view. I don't really think it's that alternative. And I call it A Search for Inner and Outer Truth. And it's a podcast about life. And partly, to be honest, my motive was that as soon as I started the John Lennon one, I thought it had a shelf life of about 6 months. And after a year, I thought, well, I can keep it going for a few months. And now it's been 4 years and I've already got the next 3-4 months already recorded, having these epic conversations. And I kind of thought, if I do a podcast about life, there's no way I'll ever run out of topics. So it's partly that. So yeah, what it is, the inner truth is things like life coaching, which we'll get onto. And it's, I call it like getting yourself armor plated to take on the world. So it's self-development, psychology. I studied psychology at college years ago. And then the outer truth is how you receive information. So there is stuff about conspiracies. Again, I would like to talk about the phrase, which I guess we are.
Mm-hmm.
And how the world really works. Somewhat provably and somewhat theoretically, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of found a way of getting those two strands because my own journey about 15 years ago, I started discovering, let's say, alternative information and I started getting into self-development. So I've been on this 15-year sort of learning juggernaut and I found that there is a way of weaving those two things. So if you look after yourself and if you try and see what life is really like and what's important, you'll be in better condition physically, mentally, psychologically to tackle all the crap plus the good information that's coming in and trying to, you know, weave between the two. And then occasionally it is an impolite word would be a dumping ground for some episodes that I want to put in podcast form. So, for example, I did one about 10 Rillington Place, which is a true crime thing I'm absolutely obsessed with. I used to live in Labbot Grove and I've studied that to the hilt. And I know a few other people. I actually know a guy who wrote the only biography of John Christie, who I don't know if your listeners will have heard of him, but he was a serial killer basically in the 40s and 50s. So occasionally you get those outlier episodes, but I try and kind of weave it together. And then just recently I did an episode where I read a couple of my stories that you heard and said kind things about the other day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, almost during the conversation, I weaved them together. So it's almost like something that sometimes goes on, it's going on in my brain. But that's it really, inner and outer truth, a podcast about life. But within that, there's a load of stuff to talk about. And I typically read usually my essays and blog posts. And I found a nice sort of modus operandi. I read a bit and then I interject and then I read a bit. And I always kind of know that I'll have stuff to say because, I mean, you've been in this game long enough. After a while, you get to, you know, you trust that you'll have stuff to say about whatever topic, you know?
Yeah. That's you kind of plan a lot of stuff and then you extemporize. You plan to improvise, as it were. Yeah, it's a bit like teaching, isn't it? You have a lesson plan and you can kind of, once you've planned a lot, you can then sort of dump it in the bin if you see fit as things arise in the classroom.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So my next topic in my list of things that you have talked about on your show is cats.
Mm.
Yes, the animals, the pets, cats.
Mm.
You talked about cats in your recent episode.
Yeah.
What do you like about cats so much?
Well, yeah, it's funny that a few years ago, I would have been one of the first people to quote the thing that someone said. I don't know if it's a quote or something someone just put online. We've got the whole world in our pocket. a word of information in our pocket. You know, as I put on my podcast, we've got the Library of Alexandria in our pocket and we spend most of our time posting cat videos. And you kind of get the point that perhaps we, you know, we like trivial stuff because it's less effort than all this heavy stuff. But I'll make this a very short story. By some means, my parents came upon this cat, and it basically, it more or less ran away from its home, which was quite near my parents' home. And around COVID time, I was staying with my parents. I'm not living at home, by the way. I'm 47. I moved out of home when I was about 23. But just for a short time at COVID, I was dossing at whichever family member would take me because I was just coming back from Spain. Mm-hmm. And this cat just happened to be in a garden. And then it wasn't a rescue as such, but the family moved away and they already had 9 cats. And I sort of used my salesman tactics. And
you didn't steal it, though. You didn't steal a cat.
No, I didn't steal a cat, though. But no, it's just, I think the fascination is that we always think of them as mysterious and everyone's like, oh, we don't know why cats do things. But now with the internet, there are loads and loads of really good videos. And there's a couple of TED Talks, which I could send you later on, which I've used. They're only about 5 minutes each. And they sort of explain their behavior. So they're a very interesting mixture of quite predictable, but then quite mysterious at the same time. And I just said on the last show that I think you can learn a lot from them because they're very good at protecting themselves and they're very good at self-care. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that we people in general are probably not very good at self-care. If you really analyze it, we probably spend all our time criticizing ourselves and not treating ourselves well. So there's a thing in the self-development genre of self-love. Again, we could make a joke about that, but let's not. Mm-hmm. We'll just think it instead.
Yeah,
okay. And it can get a bit ridiculous. You know, I've seen posts where talk about self-love, look at yourself in the mirror and say, I love you and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't do that kind of thing, but the idea of just taking care of yourself and treating yourself like a friend. And the thing about cats is that people will say they're very selfish and they probably are. If you take that literally, you know, they're not particularly loyal. They get attached to the house. Generally dogs get attached to people. Cats get attached to houses. Mm. But within that, definitely with this cat, we've seen a real change because it was literally a scaredy cat when it first arrived. It would just bolt at the first loud noise or anything. And then gradually I've seen it develop. So sort of bucking that thing that animals are always the same and that animals never change. And I don't know. And obviously a lot of people will say, you know, stroking a cat and everything is very, very meditative, relaxing. And they just have a sort of obviously a peaceful thing. And my mum said something really interesting. So my parents are in their 70s and they're long retired. And my mum said, having a cat, it's like having it's a female cat. It's like having a granddaughter in the house, but a granddaughter who doesn't make any noise and doesn't take any looking after. What could be better than that?
Yeah. They always say dogs are very loyal and stuff. And but with cats, it's actually a mistake to think that they're our pets. In fact, we work for them is kind of the way it works, isn't it? But you also talked about the way that cats purr.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Was that in a TED Talk?
Mm.
The purring thing. Mm. What was that again?
It was a TED-Ed talk, which is not someone giving a speech. It's just these animated with someone narrating it. Yeah, they went through various things about their behaviour, like why they like to go on windowsills. It's because, in a nutshell, to a cat, I think I said a genteel garden in the suburbs is no different to a jungle or a forest. They kind of almost think they're in the jungle, so they're always vigilant. But yeah, apparently, I don't think this is settled science by any means, but in this video, they said something about the frequency of the purring can actually repair, bone and muscle, I think. Bone and muscle tissue.
Yeah, wow.
I think that's what I said. And they actually said that, you know, obviously a lot of people like to have a cat on them, almost, you know, sleeping on them, on their lap or whatever. And apparently, again, I can't vouch for the science, but apparently you can heal your bone and muscle tissue.
Very interesting idea, though. Yeah, yeah. The frequency of the purring somehow is therapeutic. Mm. But yeah, certainly stroking them. and having them around is good, isn't it? It's good for our mental health and stuff like that.
Definitely. Yeah, there's someone once said, 2 minutes of stroking a cat's like 6 months of therapy. You know, they're exaggerating, but you get the idea.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to move on to, I think, a completely unrelated topic, except the fact that, you know, you've talked about it recently. It's the third topic in my list, and that is the Titanic. So a wild tangent to something completely different, a complete deviation here. So the Titanic, Anthony, you did, what was it, two episodes or a whole episode about the Titanic? So why, I mean, it's a very stupid story. Sorry, it's a very stupid question, but why the Titanic? Why are you so interested in the Titanic?
Oh, okay, here we go. I did a two. Again, I wrote this massive long blog thing about 10 years ago when I was living in Spain. And with Life for Life Only, I've managed to use some of these. Like I was saying, I often read an essay I wrote years ago and interject. And I wrote this long thing on the Titanic. Yeah, it's very difficult to summarize, really. But when I, you know, often it's when the stuff you absorb when you're a kid, and it actually goes back to when I was at primary school, and I recently reconnected with an old friend, and he heard it and he remembered that one of our teachers played a probably about a 20-minute radio documentary about it. And I remember, even as I think we must have been 9 or 10, maybe 10, we were in the last year of primary school, and we were so sort of compelled by it, we actually said, oh, can we listen to that again tomorrow? I think the teacher was surprised. He's probably thinking, I'm going to get these 9-year-olds interested in a 100-year-old story of a boat sinking.
Yeah.
In a nutshell, yeah, I mean, it's such an incredible multi-layered story about society, because at that time, 1912, they were living in what's, I think Mark Twain called it, the Gilded Age. And it was a time before, you know, rock stars, but the rock stars were people like J.P. Morgan and Guggenheim, if you've heard of him, or Macy's, it's the Strausses who run Macy's in New York. So they were the celebrities, and the Titanic was at the time just incredible luxury. If you look now, it's actually tiny compared to those enormous cruise ships. I've seen a picture comparing the two. Essentially, on the ship, people will, of course, know the story from the film in 1997. Yeah, they didn't exist, obviously, but some of that wasn't too bad. It was strong on showing you the scale of it. It was strong on the special effects rather than the story.
Yeah, and the moment when the boat sinks, I mean, that's a pretty exciting part of the film, and historically accurate as well, I understand.
I mean, that bit was because, the boat split in two. But the really interesting part about it, I mean, it's such a study of society at that time and human nature, because basically you had three classes on the ship, and the upper class were at the top, the second class were in the middle, and the lower classes were at the bottom. And if you've seen, I'm sure you've seen the famous Frost Report sketch, and it's John Cleese, Ronnie Barker, and Ronnie Corbett.
Yeah.
And the upper class guy's taller. They go down in size and they say, I am upper class. I look down on him and him. I'm middle class. I look up to him and down to him.
I get a feeling of superiority over them.
Yeah.
That's the middle class guy. He's like, I get a feeling of inferiority from him because he has innate breeding. But I get a sense of superiority over him because he is lower class. And the lower class guy goes, I get a pain in the side of my neck. Because he's always having to look up at the others.
Oh, that's it. Yeah, yeah.
I look down on him because I am upper class.
I look up to him because he is upper class. But I look down on him because he is lower class. I am middle class. I know my place. I look up to them both. But I don't look up to him as much as I look up to him. Because he has got innate breeding.
I have got innate breeding, but I have not got any money. So sometimes I look up to him.
I still look up to him because although I have money, I am vulgar. But I'm not as vulgar as him. So I still look down on him. I know my place. I look up to them both. But while I'm poor, I'm industrious, honest, and trustworthy. Had I the inclination, I could look down on them. But I don't. We all know our place, but what do we get out of it?
I get a feeling of superiority over them.
I get a feeling of inferiority from him. But a feeling of superiority over him. I get a pain in the back of my neck.
Well, there's a whole thing about the classes in England as well, that the middle class protect the rich from the lower class, that they're this sort of buffer almost. Anyway, the point about it is that the position in the ship so perfectly mirrors society. But the other thing about it is that I'm sure you know that when it collided with the iceberg, there's a little bit of, there's lots of revisionism. I've got this massive 900-page book or something I read a few years ago that refuted some details of the official story. But basically, there was a kind of a gash. It made this massive gash because what they did, they actually would have been better to hit it head on. But obviously, they're not. The guy is thinking, well, I'm not just going to let this happen. So what they did, they tried to turn, but because they didn't turn quick enough, it went all along the side. It made this massive gash in the side.
Yeah.
But the whole point of it is the higher you were on the ship, the less impact it would have. So the rich people were kind of going, oh, that was a bit queer, meaning strange. Mm-hmm. Oh, what was that? They just felt this little jolt. And then the middle-class people in the middle would have felt a bit more. And then the guys working in the boiler room who are probably earning, I don't know, £5 a year or something ridiculous like that, they were the ones sort of on the front, if you think of it in war, on the front line, feeling the impact because there's gallons of water coming in every second or every minute. I don't know what the details are, but
yeah.
So it's a very interesting mirror in that if you take, for example, the financial crisis of 2008 and even COVID as well. Well, let's say the financial crisis is a better example. If you were rich in 2008, you're not going to be feeling that too much, right?
Mm.
But then obviously if you're poor, you know, your house is going to get foreclosed and there's all these stories. So it's a perfect mirror of how the poor receive disasters directly. And then the higher you are up the social scale, the less you're impacted.
Yeah.
But in the end, then you get the absolute opposite of that, is that when they were on the lifeboats, and famously there weren't enough lifeboats because the regulations, they followed the regulations and even had four extra boats. But when they all got on the lifeboat, suddenly you've got a rich guy and a very poor guy, and they have to spend 8 hours on a boat together and they can't escape each other. So yeah. It's such a fascinating story of how the classes are different, but in the end, everything's equalized. And just one final point. The other thing is that it's so utterly surreal. Try and imagine this for a second. So it's obviously, it's a horror story. It's horrific. There's 2,200 people on board. 700 get put off in the lifeboat. So obviously 1,500 odd die. Try and imagine when that boat goes down, there's 1,500 people all screaming because they're all surely all going to be screaming in freezing water where the book I had calculates you probably survive about 10 minutes if you're lucky.
So these are all they're all in the water.
Yes.
You're screaming in the water. Yeah.
Yeah.
At okay.
2:30 in the morning when, you know, about 3 hours earlier, all they would have expecting was just to go in a nice warm, you know, have a nice dinner and go to bed. It's utterly surreal. And then you've got all the story of the wireless operator. And I made a joke and I made it clear I wasn't making light of the disaster. But you've got all these ships and they've all got these very primitive radio sets, wireless sets, and they're all sending these messages. And you can see in the Cameron film and then in a film called A Night to Remember, which is a black and white film, which is quite faithful for its time. It's almost like the most primitive WhatsApp group. And I just, you know, I was trying to make light of what was a very heavy story. So you've got all these messages and sometimes they don't get the messages. Sometimes the messages get scrambled and it's like having 100 people in a WhatsApp group. You know, you get all these messages. But it's such an incredible story. And then even in death, the lower class passengers were treated differently because apparently when there was a rescue ship, not the one that picked up the passengers, one that went about a week later to try and pick up bodies. I think if they didn't have ID on them, or if they didn't, I don't know, if they looked poor or whatever, they didn't identify them and give them a dignified burial. So,
wow.
In a nutshell, it's a weird mixture of how the classes are different, but then everyone gets equalized in a disaster because a rich guy is not going to do any better in freezing water than a poor guy.
Yeah, yeah. Very interesting. So it's really a sort of a little kind of case study about class in the last century.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really okay. Interesting. What do you think about it? Can I turn it back on you?
I don't know. I mean, I think the story's really, really compelling, of course, because of that sense of what's the word for it, where you're super confident, but then it all comes crashing down.
Complacency,
complacency. But there's another one, the sort of Greek kind of myth one. The word will come to me.
Okay, it was described as a Greek tragedy in the book, A Night to Remember, because loads of things went wrong. And also, the other thing about it is that
hubris of it. Yeah, this, you know, the idea, we've made this unsinkable boat and it's kind of like the pinnacle of modern engineering and stuff. And there's a sort of romantic element to it as well, with all these high society people in this kind of very sort of, very modern moment. And then, in the moonlight, there's no moon. It's just a completely black sky, isn't it, with stars. It was a moonless night and the cloudless sky.
Yeah, there was another weird thing, actually. The lights stayed on, apparently, until about almost 30 seconds before the ship sank. Incredible timing. They managed to, I don't know exactly how that works. It's something to do with the boilers keeping the furnace going. They're keeping the lights on, keeping the electricity on. And these guys, you know, they were working till almost the end, and the wireless operator. So there's lots of heroic stories. But then there was a story that, I don't know, because it's very easy to get on the backs of rich people because they are, the really rich people do, it's almost impossible for them to be really in touch with the common man, even if they want to be. But there's some story that as it was going down, there was I think he was called Cosmo Duff Gordon. You can imagine how rich he was, and Lady Gordon. There was one, the other thing about it, that one of the boats only had 12 people out of 40. They were also underloaded. That's another story that I can't really go into now. And apparently, as it went down, this lady said to her assistant, "Oh, you'll never get your nightdress back." And it almost seems a bit of a Hollywood thing, because, you know, there's that sort of liberal underdog element that Hollywood loves putting in its stories. Mm. That sort of idea, rich people bad, poor people good, which was in the Cameron film.
Yeah.
In one of the English books, actually. Class conscious overkill, they called it.
Is it in like a Headway or English File or something? I bet it's
live, everybody.
The Cutting Edge.
No, New English File.
New English File. Classic course book.
Oh, I can't find it.
Which level? That sounds like an upper intermediate or an advanced one. Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah. Sorry, there's one final thing. Yeah, the other thing was that it was a very complacent age, as you said, full of hubris. There is a story that there's a line that Jack the Ripper, which is the famous Whitechapel, that was the end of the 19th century, quote, gave birth to the 20th century because it woke the society up. Because before that, they probably never thought that anyone serial killer could exist. Titanic was 2 years before the First World War started. It was also 1 year, in fact, before income tax and the Federal Reserve were introduced.
That's interesting.
On the more conspiratorial side. But it was just on the cusp of this 4 year sort of slaughter fest, which was the First World War. So it was innocence was gradually going. And then obviously the 20th century was the death of innocence, really, if you think about it.
Yeah.
With everything that happened. So,
and the postmodern era, you know, like modernism gets to this point where it's like progress, making progress and sort of technological progress, until it gets to a point where it's sort of like, yeah, these disasters happen and the technology ends up being sort of catastrophic for humans with the machine guns in World War One and all the rest of it. And that sort of, I guess, led to that postmodern era, which is a rejection of a lot of those ideas of progress and modernization. Yeah. And that sort of leads us into that sort of second half of the last century, which was all about questioning what it's all about and questioning all the narratives and stuff that we'd all ascribed to.
Yeah, a friend of mine was, we were chatting, we talk a lot about, you know, the modern world and media and stuff. And he came up with a great line. He said, no one's quite sure when people are being truthful or ironic. Like, everything is so topsy-turvy now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the news to me, mainstream news, so resembles a kind of comedy show, like a bad comedy show. Because
like the day-to-day.
Exactly, yeah. And you did a good, I watched one of your stand-up videos that's on YouTube, right? And you were talking about how the media talks like this. Today, 200 people died in an air crash in Nigeria. You know,
it's up here. It's, you know, reports are coming in of an air crash in Nigeria.
Yeah.
That kind of. It's very strange. I'm talking, you know, like, yeah, I don't know what the story would be. Reports have come in indicating that up to 1,500 people have been injured in the accident.
Yeah.
You know, experts are yet to make a statement. That sort of weird register, that this tone that they speak in.
It's so strange. And the other thing is that, again, I was listening to a podcast, I can't remember which one it was, and they were saying, if you really look at the news, it's like, da-da-da-dum, it's exciting music, colourful, lots of bright colours, blues and greens and reds, maybe not reds, blues and greens.
Mm.
And it's basically, here's loads of bad news, here's a nice bit of news at the end about a cat being rescued from a tree. Join us tomorrow for more shit news. Essentially, that is what they're saying. Join us tomorrow for up-to-the-minute news. Here's loads of shit news, which is going to make you afraid of the world. You know, but don't worry, you know, sleep tight, as Bill Hicks would say. Bill Hicks is one of my heroes, as you know.
Next topic, Anthony, is travelling. You've travelled around a bit, haven't you? You've been around a bit.
I've been around the block a few times, yeah.
So tell me about your travelling experiences. Where have you been? And what counts as your favourite or most memorable or perhaps even life-changing travelling experience that you've had?
Well, could I mention the one that I put in the last podcast? Because I think that worked really well as a metaphor and I wasn't really intending it. And again, it was a funny thing where I was reading it and then had a bit of a brainwave, if you like. What have I been? Well, I lived in Thailand. And briefly lived in Laos as well. So Vietnam, Cambodia, been around that area. South America, been to a couple of places, Colombia, Ecuador. I went to India. We could talk about that if you want. It's indescribable. It's the only way I can describe it or not describe it. it's a weird one, India, because obviously the British Empire is so implicated in India's quote-unquote development. And some people will say, well, they absolutely destroyed the country. I did meet people in India. You know, I had a lot of conversations on trains because educated Indians do tend to speak good English.
Mm.
And a lot of them like the British Empire and what the British did. But, you know, in Spain, they're supporters of Franco. I mean, I had a massive, well, they had an argument, but they were good friends. So it was a sort of a heated debate.
Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Merton, let's have a heated debate. It was one of those, no. And, India, it's so weird. In Delhi, okay, which is the capital, I think officially the capital is it called New Delhi or is it Delhi? I don't know. Not sure. It was New Delhi, wasn't it?
Yes.
Hmm.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, anyway.
I can check.
Yeah, if you think of Delhi, you can definitely make a distinction between New and Old Delhi. And they had the Commonwealth Games, for example, in New Delhi. And if you go to the good areas of Delhi, there are these lovely, quite wide boulevards and it's pretty clean. And then you go to Old Delhi and it's like something you can't even describe, you know, the amount of people. And I took a lot of photos and made some videos while I was there. And, you know, there's loads and loads of rubbish and, you know, there's such a clear distinction. And Thailand, I was sort of thought of India as a more extreme version of Thailand, because in Thailand, you see old buildings next to plush hotels. You see that side by side. But Thailand is developing. Obviously, India is developing in one sense, but I would argue that really it's only the top portion of it that's developing, while the rest is getting worse and worse.
Sorry. By the way, I think that New Delhi is the name of the city and Delhi is the name of the area that the city is in. Okay. But that's my quick answer. So, yeah, I mean, we talked about a class system in the UK. I mean, they still have or used to have that caste system in India, which obviously is, you know, it's probably going to be reflected in the way that, the sort of upper classes are the ones that are getting all the benefits of the development that are happening there. And it's a certain type of development where the underclass probably still live in complete poverty.
Or going
and
lower, like, even. Going
yeah, lower, lower. You'll probably, I mean, like India is one of the developing economies, isn't it, as well? And also the population is... rapidly increasing, and is it already or going to be more populous than China?
I'm just gonna say we're just reaching a point. I haven't checked recently. They're almost exactly the same, and they are almost not quite 50% of the world. Again, listeners can check that, can't they? But it's something like 2 billion each, and the population of the world's about 8 billion. So we're just reaching an interesting point where they're about the same and they're about 50% of the world. Probably not quite, but... I mean, imagine the whole country was locked down. Can you imagine that?
Yeah, it's
incredible.
1.5 billion
or however many it is.
Yeah, insane.
But yeah, I had this travel story. Basically, I was traveling around the Mekong Delta. This was before I lived in Thailand. I did the old backpacking. A bit later than my gap year. I think it was about 23, 24, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And... I read this story just before in my last podcast, and it was funny because I went backpacking. My first port of call was Thailand, but because I didn't know anything about it, and someone had actually told me, "Oh, when you get to Thailand, you get out of the airport, you'll probably be like really afraid. You know, you'll be going, 'Oh my God, what is this? What have I walked into?'" And of course, in reality, it's not really like that, particularly as the backpacking circuit. I don't know what it's like now, but 20 years ago, whenever that was, it's all, you know, they direct you to certain places and everything. But what was funny was that I think the amount you pack your suitcase is quite a nice metaphor for how kind of insecure you are. Because if you pack it to the hilt, it's almost like saying, I don't want anything spontaneous or weird to happen. I want to be like in control. And what was so funny was that I had this backpack and it was so packed with, you know, stuff like water purification tablets that I'd never need because I'd read this book. It was so funny. It was so hard on my back because I've always had a few back problems that weirdly enough, it had a handle on the side. So I ended up carrying it, which is obviously like carrying it like a suitcase. And the whole point is that I'm a backpacker. I'm not a tourist. I use a backpack, not a suitcase. And here I am carrying like a suitcase. So I remember laughing at myself, you know, that.
Because you were so concerned about having clean water to drink that you were willing to break your back carrying the water purification tablets around.
Or just in general, I think I'd read there was a book literally called Before You Go, and it was all right. But I think it was designed for people going to really remote areas.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, to cut a very long story short, I lost my backpack. It was a kind of a mix up between two boats of different companies, but they weren't marked. They may not, to be honest, they may not even be real companies. I don't know. But yeah. I lost my backpack and it was going to take hours or I'd have to come back the next day. And I was actually on a tour. So I suddenly thought, oh, whatever, I'll just let it go.
And you had you had your passports and your money and stuff in a like a bum bag kind of thing.
Yeah.
So you had to like say farewell to your bag. You'd probably never see it again after it went off on another boat.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is that the sort of programmed reaction is to go, oh no, I've lost all my stuff. But then someone that I was traveling with said almost for a joke, oh well, you were complaining that you weren't traveling light enough. And that's when I thought, yes, I'm traveling light. Look at this. All I've got's this. What a player I am, you know. What a great traveler I am. But then I suddenly thought, well, you know, because people will lend you stuff. If you ever get in an emergency, I mean, even if you're in the street and you get in an emergency, the average passerby, if they're a decent person, will probably help you in some way.
Yeah.
And that's what you learn. So I learned that all I'd been doing up to then was just controlling everything. So like I say, again, it's different if you have a stressful job and you want to go away for 2 weeks in the sun. You know, I'm not saying in any stretch that's a bad thing at all. But the idea of this was that we had months and we were traveling on a budget. But then I found that I was just controlling everything. And then suddenly I had this wonderful opportunity inadvertently to be more free and spontaneous. So I just thought it worked well. And that going with the spirit of life and life only, I had the idea of like traveling light in your mind, you know, being detached. And not trying to control everything and not trying to predict. There's a term in life coaching. It's like clairvoyance or something, but in a bad way, in that we're always trying to predict the future and we're always preempting the future.
Mm.
You know, so it was living in the moment. So you can travel light in your mind, basically.
Yeah. So it kind of like taught you to kind of let go a bit and to kind of not worry too much and not try to control everything that's happening. Must have been quite liberating.
Yeah, definitely. But it taught me a lesson. I've never forgotten it. And then years and years later, when I started a blog, which is pre-podcasts, I thought, well, I'll write about that. And, you know, I stuck a couple of details in, but it was basically a true story.
Yeah, it's a good episode. Yeah, I liked it.
Yeah.
Moving on to teaching English, which you've done in several places. So I wanted to talk to you about not so much like the learning English and teaching side of it, but more the experience as an English teacher of working with other people. So having a group class or having a one-to-one lesson and having to deal with the group dynamics or the interpersonal dynamics. How have you found that? How have you managed to deal with that sense of interpersonal dynamics when you're teaching a group of people?
Right. Well, since I'm a psychology guy, as you know, I mean, I in one way, it's a wonderful, same as I was manager of a William Hill and I hated, it's a betting shop for those who don't know. And I hated the job, but as a sort of anthropological study, it was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
So, well, as you know, if you look at it in a technical way, we've got all these icebreaker things to, you know, and let's say you get a group of 10 adults. I haven't really taught children since. 1 year I did.
I was never again.
Defeated. Yeah, I was defeated. Apart from the occasion, I had a teenage class in Italy, but they're all quite high level. I think that's important, isn't it? Say you get a group of 10 adults who probably have never met each other. It's very interesting that, you know, if you get them learning each other's names, then that's fine. You know, and there's practical stuff you do. But what I found amazing is that occasionally you get 10 people, they come in a room, and for some reason, as soon as they sit down, even before they've talked to each other, there's a warm atmosphere and you just kind of know it's going to go well. And it just goes really well just from the first second. Of course, that lifts me and you and your teaching. You know, we need to be lifted by the students as well as the other way around, right? And then I've had other classes and I just do exactly the same thing. But for some reason, they just either don't like each other or they're just not interested in each other or maybe they're just really reserved. And you can always tell because those classes, they won't use each other's names. You know, when you get them doing group stuff, and I often get them, you know, you do pair work in threes or whatever, but I like doing stuff where one person has to ask a question across the room.
Yeah.
And you go around and either in a chain or something
running
like that.
Dictations and things like that.
Yeah, things like that. So they're just forced to interact. But then you'll find they'll often say, oh, you, instead of using their name.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
This could be after 3-4 months. And it's bizarre. I can't quite explain it. So obviously it's a good challenge. So really the dynamics thing is interesting. And on the more humorous side, you must have had this. Have you ever had this sort of grammar fiends? I like people who like grammar because I actually love teaching grammar.
Mm-hmm.
I'm fascinated by grammar. But have you ever had a student who sort of sits there not saying much and then out of the blue, for just no reason, you'll go, can you explain past modals? What's the difference between may have, might have, and could have? And I'm like, oh, where did that come from?
Yeah.
Have you ever had that? Like,
definitely.
Shouting out random grammar questions. It's hilarious, really.
So there's the people who basically their entire experience of learning English has been sort of studying the grammar in painstaking detail.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they find themselves in a classroom. And so this is now their, they have to somehow square, you know, put this, what is it? You know, they have to put these two things together of like, so I've learned, my journey of learning English so far has been understanding the rules. And now here I am in this kind of communication situation. And so, yeah, they kind of like, well, I better try and impose my knowledge of grammar here. And they will ask a question about grammar, which isn't a question. It's just, it's a test, in fact. Yeah, I've been tested lots of times by students.
Yeah.
They're like sending out these testing questions and you suddenly feel like, yeah, you're being tested and you have to think on your feet. And also other questions like personal questions that they ask you as well to test you.
Yeah.
Like they'll just ask you if you're married and things like that. But going back to that thing about having, like, you do exactly the same thing. One group, it just goes really well. Things go really smoothly. And another group, you do the same thing, and it's just a total disaster. Mm. I've also found the atmosphere in a room to be completely different. So I've taught, like, for example, in the same classroom, teaching one group where everything's going really well, and you remember the room, you remember that group, the room seems so much smaller in your memory.
Mm.
When you remember like a really good group that you got on with, it feels like it was a small room. And then teaching to another group in the same room, but they don't get on with each other and there's a horrible atmosphere. It feels like there's acres of space in the room. Mm. And also the air seems so much thicker and heavier. It's a really weird phenomenon. It's the same thing in stand-up as well. You get some rooms where you just feel that there's something really good in the air and everyone's responding really well on the same wavelength, and then you get the same another room and you do the same material and it's just a tumbleweed, you know. So I don't understand that. I suppose it's just the combination of individuals. It's like, you know, you mix them up and you see what you get. Some of them are going to go together well and others just not. But that's a very weird thing.
As I was going to say, I rely on inspiration to some extent. I mean, I can do quite a mechanical lesson if I have to. Mm-hmm. I think I transmit, I'm sure you're the same, I transmit enthusiasm when I'm enthusiastic. And I make a professional job of not transmitting boredom, but they probably, when I taught kids, I felt like they were picking up on absolutely everything, you know. The adults maybe a bit less, but. It's not that the classes necessarily go badly. It's just for some reason they're not interested in each other, you know.
Mm.
But I suppose then my more professional side would kick in and I'd do a more professional, more standard class.
Yeah.
But with the other ones, I think what you're saying is absolutely right. The room seems smaller because everything's more intimate. And funnily enough, if you watch when people are more, well, we always think that open body language is being like this, but people actually lean in. If you notice, if you have lots of people around a table and it's quite intimate and everyone's sharing personal stuff in a nice way, everyone leans in. So it is literally like there's a bit less space. It's really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Mm. What was I going to say? I was going to say something deeply profound. I was going to ask you actually if you've ever taught in weird situations. Like, have your classrooms always been fairly reasonable? Have your teaching environments always been sort of fairly good, fairly decent, or have you ever taught in weird situations?
Well, right at the beginning, when I moved to Thailand, I didn't have a job sorted, but there are, you know, it's not that difficult to find a job over there. Mm. But the first couple of jobs I had were just terrible, really, but it was just in at the deep end. And to make a generalization, Thai people are pretty non-confrontational. So in a way, it's the best breeding ground, if you like. But it was quite funny. I went to this school. Originally, I was going to be teaching in a high school, which I never actually did. And I did a trial class. And
in a high school with kids, were they like teenagers?
Yeah, they're about 12 or 13. But the thing about, again, generalizing Thai kids, they're not so much disruptive. They just look really bored if they're bored. And it's really hot all the time. And the worst schools don't have any air conditioning or fans. So everyone's sweating and they just get sleepier and sleepier. And there was a Thai woman, probably maybe 40, 45 years old. Mm-hmm. And she was at the back of the class watching me. And I had to do about half an hour with 40 to 45, 12 or 13. And I'm thinking, oh my God, what am I going to do? So I thought, I'll start with a joke.
The perfect audience. Of course, they're going to get it and react.
Yeah, of course they're going to get it. Yeah. So I said, right, I want all your names. And I started from, you know, as if I was going to get every 45 people's names.
Yeah.
And the woman at the back just sort of, what? And there was a teacher there, this is really interesting, who'd learned Thai, because some people can learn Thai, Chinese, Japanese, those kind of languages that seem almost impossible when you hear them. Mm. He'd learned really good Thai, but he hadn't told anyone he was learning Thai because he wanted to know what the Thai people were saying about him. And I won't divulge some of the stuff he said, but he said to me, can I swear? Or,
yeah.
Yeah. He said to me, this middle-aged woman said in Thai to her colleague, what the fuck is this idiot doing? In Thai. He said that's a basic translation of what she said. So I was ready to go home. And it was just awful. And then I found what they call a language school or a language academy. And then suddenly it's one-to-ones and, classes of six, seven. Yeah, exactly. Mm. I've probably had all kinds of stuff. Just people who appear. Have you ever had students who they just don't appear for 20 classes?
Yeah.
They've blown all their money and then they suddenly appear and they go, can you tell me what you've done since I've been away? And it's like,
it'd be easier to tell you what we haven't done.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, can you, yeah. Can you, well, they come back as if nothing's happened. It's like, ready to fit back in. And it's like, and they say, can you give me photocopies of everything I've missed? It's like, what?
Yeah, like, are you kidding?
That's about half a tree. I need to photocopy for you.
You do get some very flaky students. Yeah. I've had some pretty dodgy classrooms before. I taught in a room in London and I was writing on the whiteboard. It was a very sort of dilapidated old building. And I was up in the cobwebby sort of rooms at the top of the building, writing on a this sketchy old whiteboard. Mm. And the whiteboard just fell off the wall. It just popped off the wall, clam, slam onto the floor at everyone's feet. Yeah. And so I just propped it up against the wall and it left a sort of clean space because all the wallpaper around the whiteboard was filthy and disgusting. Mm. But when the whiteboard fell off, it left this perfect clean space that was actually cleaner than the whiteboard itself. Yeah. And so I could just continue the lesson and wrote on the wall where the whiteboard had been, and it was a kind of a gloss paint. So it actually worked better just writing directly on the wall than it did writing on the whiteboard. So just in the middle of the lesson, the whole thing just came down. Everyone was shocked, and I just moved it to one side and just carried on writing on the wall. Taught in a little cupboard once when the school was like full, and they put me into this little cupboard. And we were all sitting around with our knees kind of touching each other, like about six of us in the room. And I had the whiteboard leaning up against a door, and every time anyone tried to come in, the door would slam me on the back of the head. lots of other stupid things like that. Mm. It's good. I wish I had recordings of all of the stupid and funny moments that have come up in English lessons over the years, because there have been a lot, like including people saying really weird and stupid things and just odd moments and funny characters. I wish I'd recorded it all.
Yeah.
I think we'll move on, though, Anthony, as we kind of like, you know, move from thing to thing here. Life coaching is the next thing. So this is another thing that you do. So life coaching, what is it and how do you do it?
Yeah, right. So life coaching is a fairly modern invention, if you like. It's probably about 30 years ago, I think, in America. How do I explain it? It's a little bit, it's slightly undefined. The way I look at it, if you had severe stress or, well, severe anxiety or severe depression, you would need to go to a therapist, a licensed therapist. In a sense, a life coach, if you had, let's say, if you were quite stressed or you had some level of anxiety, but not chronic anxiety, or you didn't seem to have a direction or whatever it was, you're not very good at managing your life, perhaps, then you might go to a life coach. And I did write a thing about this ages ago. I think it was one of the Life and Life Only episodes, I think, yeah. And I tried to define it. It's almost a bit like, it's a bit like a friend. There's a placebo element to it, because if you're talking to someone who you feel has knowledge and knows what they're talking about, it's like the placebo thing with a doctor. When someone goes to a doctor they like, they often magically get better. You know, even if you gave them, even if you gave them a pill that didn't mean anything and said, "Oh, I believe strongly in this," they go, "Oh, yes, doctor." You know, so there's a placebo element to it, but it's, yeah, I suppose it's, it could be seen as a first step towards therapy, or as a separate thing. But it's basically people who are struggling with motivation, and it's a conversation. You know, I think I noted on that podcast you heard recently, it's interesting with my life. I've always been struggling with identity, and now I find myself. So I do English classes, life coaching. I have a meetup group. I do podcasts and I write. And in a funny way, often an idea from a meetup group will end up in my English class. An idea from an English class will end up in my whatever podcast. And I've realized in the end, it's all about conversations. So life coaching is essentially an ongoing dialogue. And, you know, you have to know what you're doing. Obviously, you have to have some knowledge and there's practical steps. But you suss out generally, some people are looking for very practical steps. So maybe they're in America, they have these really cheesy slogans like, "I'm great, but I want to be even better." It's that kind of thing. So some people, it's successful people and they want to be even more successful. You know, they want to learn like loads of really good practical motivational tips. And I could do that. You know, it's rather like an English, you know, as we're saying with an English class, someone say, "I want to improve my grammar or my vocab. I don't want any sort of funny stories or interesting conversation. I just want that and that." And I can do that. But like with the English teaching, I much prefer having an interesting dialogue that gets quite intimate, and I share stuff about my life. And it's just a really nice dialogue. And I name checked a guy called Daryl, and he just wrote to me actually because he heard the podcast. Yeah, it's a dialogue, and what you get out of it is that you can make improvements. But the thing with life coaching is that the person already has the answers, and you never use, you'll appreciate this as an English teacher, you never use modals like should and could. You say, "Perhaps you could do this. Have you considered doing this?" But it doesn't have a set thing. Essentially, it's, if you think of it as someone paying money for a service, whether that's English or anything, I try and think of it as in the same envelope as my English teaching in a way, although they're obviously going to be native speakers. Although funnily enough, I was coaching a Spanish lady last year and there was some English element to it as well. So it's, in a nutshell, it's a dialogue helping people improve their life. So there is a therapeutic aspect to it.
Do you ever find that the two sort of switch over, that you just mentioned life coaching, which kind of included bits of English training? Do you ever find that as an English teacher, you end up becoming a sort of a life coach for your students as well?
Absolutely.
What are some of the most common areas that you have to deal with in that regard? Is this motivation just, and stuff?
Yeah.
Confidence issues.
A lot of it is stress. I'm sure you've found this. You often teach business, stressed out business men or women. And they get a double whammy. They get to get everything off their chest while speaking English. So it works great for them. And you do feel like, you know, you are a listener sometimes. But like I was saying, yeah, I mean, those two overlap, the meetup overlaps. I think when I start talking about stuff, and I often impart stuff I've learned from, you know, self-development books or podcasts or whatever it is, And it just gradually develops, really. But it's just, you know, they might be stressed. They might be lacking direction. It could be anything, really.
But I
prefer the emotional side to the practical side. But there's a bit of both, obviously.
Yeah, definitely. I often hear teachers talking about how they also have to be therapists for their students, because there's often learning English, it's not just about, you know, learning the language and using it, but the mentality and dealing with confidence issues is a huge part of it. And you sometimes get the impression that people are blocked in terms of pronunciation because it's all messed up with their identity and how they feel about themselves and things like that. French people, for example, you said you have a lot of French students. French people mostly, generally, are quite traumatized, or maybe I should just say they've all gone through bad experiences at school, and now they've got these sort of major confidence issues around speaking English because they remember the way that they were treated at school, and like lessons at school are all not very much fun. They're all about translating grammar and lots of written work, and they get like very severely criticized and sort of almost punished by their teachers for making mistakes, and they get judged between each other too. So it sort of creates the environment in which speaking English for them is like really a stressful, problematic thing. And a lot of French people have got very good English as well. They don't admit it, or they're not willing to admit it to themselves. They might have a strong accent, but a lot of especially the vocab, actually translates really well for them. Mm. So my wife, for example, she's French, and she'll be talking to my parents and she'll say something and they'll be like, wow, your English is good. And she'll say to me, actually, to be honest, it's just the same in French. I just translated it.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And often like translating from French to English results in this very impressive English.
It sounds more elegant, doesn't it? Because they're taking the Latin words. So often, it's same in obviously Spanish, Italian as well. If you translate it directly, it comes out as really fancy because it's the Latin word, the longer word. You
know? Yeah, that's right.
Definitely.
Yeah. But nevertheless, you know, French people often have confidence issues, which is like a whole other set of things. You can't really solve those problems with grammar rules or phonemes and stuff like that. So there is always that other element, the human element.
Do you teach, what kind of levels do you teach, or do you teach all levels?
I teach all levels. This year, for some reason, my boss has given me B1 classes, so I'm teaching B1, good solid B1. And last year it was B2. So those are great. I love B2. I think it's my favorite level. B1 is great too.
Yeah.
C2 is also fantastic. But then you're dealing with like a situation where for a lot of the students at C1, that's it. They're not going to get better than that, and getting through to C2 is a bit of a mystery, and it's very hard to get to C2 in English because that means being flawless, but also having a certain control and certain level of naturalness in the language, and it's hard to really acquire that unless you have sort of grown up in the country or something like that. But having said that, I've met lots of students who do, through sheer sort of bloody mindedness and by focusing and studying, they actually do break through to C2. So that's an amazing thing. What about you? What kind of groups do you teach at the moment?
Well, at the moment, I'm literally only doing remote.
So it'd be one-to-one.
Like this, one-to-one with adults. Yeah. But I found myself a niche. Yeah, B1 upwards, as I'm the same. Just for my listeners, maybe you don't know what we're talking about. So B1 is right in the middle, isn't it? Solid intermediate, fairly good. B2 is upper intermediate. C1 is advanced. C2 is proficiency. Mm. That's very good. But then I do have, I am teaching a lady who is A2, let's call it, elementary. And I was really dreading it, I'll be honest. But it's a different journey. It's quite nice. And it feels almost a little bit more quote unquote real teaching because you're taking someone from the ground up almost.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not saying that obviously higher levels is not real teaching. It is. It's just a different thing.
It's a softer kind of thing, isn't it, at high level? There's a lot more sort of, fluff that goes along with it, in the sense that you end up getting into topics and getting into pragmatics and stuff. Whereas at A2 level, it's about conjugating all the verbs in you know, third person and negatives, and then dealing with different tenses and the basics, absolute basics. Yeah, it's always a frightening prospect when you get an elementary class. You think, oh my God, because there's no sort of breathing space. You know, in an advanced class, you can always kind of have a discussion for 15 minutes if you need to. But with an elementary group, there's really nowhere you can
There's no flow, really, is there?
Having said that, you can get to a state where there is some flow, but you have to be quite contrived about it. So you end up doing things like playing very limited and controlled kinds of games and things, or having role play conversations where basically they're just moving around the room, having exactly the same interaction with the same with different people. But what do you do? I'm a teacher. What are you doing at the moment? I'm learning French, you know, and just those sorts of things. Absolutely. It's possible to create role plays where you encourage the students to use certain bits of language. I was going to say, I've come up with some stupid things before. Like I came up with one which was a village idiot, right? So there's this town somewhere in England and everyone in the town is an idiot, but there's one especially stupid person. And they're all unemployed in this town as well. And this guy is going around and he meets people and he basically says, what are you doing? And then they say what they're doing. And he goes, all right, okay, cool. How long have you been doing that then? And they're like, so it's like, what are you doing? Oh, I'm throwing rocks into this lake. Oh, right, cool. How long have you been doing that? Oh, I don't know. I've been doing it about half an hour. How many rocks have you thrown in? And it's purely to
perfect,
present perfect, simple and continuous. How long have you been doing it? How many have you done? And so that can go on forever. And it's like really funny as well if you get them to do really stupid things. Like, oh, what are you doing? I'm thinking about Pamela Anderson. Oh, right. How long have you been,
thinking about her?
Yeah. You can come up with some pretty stupid examples. So it can be pretty funny, but you have to think about it a bit more carefully.
Yeah, I find it hard at first. It's just one very quick story when we were talking about English teaching. In Thailand, I've had high-level students. There are some very high-level students. Generally, people who've lived abroad. And we were talking about Thai society, and we made the same point that when you go outside your own country and then come back, you get a much better idea of the limitations of your own culture.
Yeah.
And to me, as a Westerner, Thai culture seemed more extreme and it was more collectivist. This guy, he'd learned this word collectivist and he was really happy with it. And we had a long discussion about individual versus collective. And that in schools, you were saying about the other students laughing at them. In Thailand, they have a brutal sense of humor. It's just a different sense of humor and it involves laughing. So if someone makes a mistake in a class of 40, almost the whole rest of the class would just point and laugh, and it can imagine. But then I'd have students who would, if they were, you know, from quite moneyed families, they'd be able to go abroad to Australia. They went often because it's nearer America or Britain or Ireland as well. And often a couple of people came back. They were young people, 18, 19. They came back from 3 months in Australia or the States, and they'd want to talk about Thai culture. And you just would not recognize the person who'd left. I mean, one guy came back with an Australian accent, which is hilarious. Really authentic as well.
Oh, yeah. G'day, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just back from Australia.
A bit like that, yeah. It's sort of more of a relaxed, so that kind of relaxed Australian. But it was so funny. But that's one of the best things about the job sometimes, obviously seeing the journey, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Especially with like sort of younger university age students who kind of learn and then, I had that experience in Japan meeting sort of younger students and teaching them for a few months, and then they off they go to have some experience. They come back and they're like, they've totally grown up and everything. Strange. Yeah, yeah, it's incredible. Yeah, teaching's amazing. One of the things I love about doing the podcast as well is that the thing about teaching is that you would teach students for maybe a few weeks or a few months, and then it's like, bye, see you, that's it. And then they go away and you never ever see them ever again. You never get a sense of what happened next. So there was always that sense that, like, with teaching, you're just constantly saying goodbye to these people. Yeah. But with the podcast, what I like about it is that there's this sense of like a long-term thing, and that this linear sort of long-term thing, and also some people have listened to episodes for a long time and they tell you about their progress and their journey, and you get the you know, you really get the sense of how it works long term, rather than just over a few weeks. You know, the impact that you have over a few weeks versus the impact you have over months and months and years and stuff. It's really good. I find that the podcast, people have told me that like listening to the podcast long term has really helped. So that's very satisfying.
Oh, of course,
as a teacher. Yeah.
Very much so. Yes.
Anthony, so we are halfway through the topics. Right?
We knew it was going to happen though, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. So, and I don't have time to finish all of this off because to talk about the other ones, we'd need to, you know, have a bit more time because there's some good topics in there. So would you be available/willing to kind of conclude this conversation at a later date?
Yeah. Should we do a bit more or have you got time now?
I don't really have time because I've got to go and pick up my daughter, which is sort of unexpected thing. So I think it's probably best if we pause here and then we can continue and deal with the other six topics that I've got lined up for you later on.
Should we do a quick plug for the other thing we're doing in a few days?
Sure. So next week we're going to do a recording for one of your shows, Film Gold.
Mm.
We're going to talk about a film which I've been sort of mildly obsessed with since I saw it last year, I think. My brother was always going on about this film. He'd always say, oh, have you seen Sorcerer yet?
Mm.
And I've been like, oh, I haven't got around to seeing it. And I finally saw it and it kind of blew me away. So, and I was keen to talk to, so I just need to talk to someone about it.
Yeah, I've got to talk to someone, yeah.
So we're going to talk about Sorcerer next week on your podcast. So people will be able to listen to that at some point. I don't know when that will be out, but maybe by the time this is published, which will probably be in the summer. Maybe it'll be available.
Oh, really? You're publishing this in the summer?
Yeah, I expect so. Right. You thought I would publish it straight away, did you?
I had no idea. No, I didn't.
I've got a huge pipeline queue of episodes. I'm just pumping out episodes because my wife is pregnant with our second child.
Ah, congratulations.
Thank you. So the child is due at the beginning of July, so I am trying to make as many episodes as I can so that I can get like about 2 months without having to record anything. So this will be, by the time this comes out, I'll probably be sitting on the end of a bed somewhere desperately trying to stop an infant from crying or something like that. Mm.
Okay. Exciting.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Anthony, thank you so much for talking to us all about these sort of various things.
Yeah.
I guess people can listen to the actual podcast if they want to, if they want to hear more of this kind of stuff. What's the best place to get your stuff? How do people find your work?
It's basically everywhere. Life and Life Only is on Podbean, if you want to go to the actual website. And there's a YouTube version, which I use a different picture for each episode. So it's quite eye-catching when you look at it. And that was episode 37, the last one. But we'll be talking about other ones, won't we? But yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I read a couple of stories. So it was a travel story, and then there was a weird one called Pure Heaven. I don't know.
Tell
me next time what you thought about that, because it was weird. It was during a period of insomnia, and I woke up and almost wrote this story, not quite automatically, but it was the closest I've ever come to automatic writing, as they call it. Because then I managed to get back to sleep, and when I woke up, I sort of had a vague memory. What was I doing at 4 o'clock this morning? And it's called Pure Heaven, and it was quite pure in a sense that I'd never really done that before. So,
It's an interesting story. As I was listening to it, I was like thinking, wow, this is pretty inventive stuff. And I was kind of like half listening at the beginning as you told the story at the start of your story. Mm. You describe, so basically this is a story, listener, about how Anthony ends up going to heaven and he describes what it's like in heaven and stuff. And but you also talk about how you get killed and how you end up going there. And you, in the story, you get stabbed as part, like there's a fight outside a pub and you get stabbed. And I was listening to this and thinking, oh shit, did he really get stabbed? So for a moment, I thought it was real, but then I realized, this is his story that he came up with.
Yeah.
And then you end up in heaven. Very interesting stuff. Mm. So Life and Life Only, listeners, you can get it wherever you get your podcasts. You'll find links in the description or on the page for this episode on my website. I must go now because I've got to make sure that my child isn't left sort of defenseless, hope just on her own, fending for herself in the middle of Paris. I need to go and get her. It's been great to talk to you, Anthony. And
Should we stay on the line for a minute or something?
Yeah, we'll stay on the line for a minute after I stop recording. Okay. But yeah, I look forward to doing part two.
Excellent. Thanks a lot.
Cheers. Okay, so that's the end of part one of this double episode. I hope you've been finding this interesting. As I said before, if you like this kind of stuff, if you like hearing Anthony talk about these sorts of sort of deep and meaningful things, and you know, you like the sound of his voice and all the rest of it, then you should check out his podcast. It's called Life and Life Only. It's available wherever you get your podcasts. You'll find links on the episode page for this or episode on my website and stuff. Okay, all right. I think I'm just going to end here. I'm not going to do any big rambling stuff because, you know what? The reason for that is that I'm absolutely starving, so I'm going to go and have lunch. Obviously, I'm recording this on another day after I actually had the interview with Anthony. I'm not just going to, like, let my daughter... I'm not just going to leave my daughter alone and go, hey, you know what? Instead of picking her up, I think I'll just go and have lunch. Yeah, fine. No, I did pick up my daughter. That was another day. But today... it's a different day. You understand? You understand? Yeah. Okay, fine. Good. Okay. It's lunchtime for me. I'm going to go and have lunch. I'm absolutely starving. So it's lunchtime. Time for a lunch break. You too, maybe. Maybe you're going to have lunch now as well, or breakfast or dinner. In any case, enjoy your food. And I will speak to you again on the podcast soon. Okay. Thanks again to Anthony for taking part in this episode. And yeah, speak to you in the next part, which should be coming along to your podcast app of choice very soon. Okay, thanks so much for listening, and I'll speak to you next time. But for now, it's time to say goodbye. Bye, 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 bye. Thanks for listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk. If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humour and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.